not only a distinguished, long published critic of modern and contemporary art, but a highly celebrated art historian of art ranging from the 18th century, particularly his work on Diderot, through to Manet and beyond. And although I think for a number of people who said to me, oh, Michael Fried is coming to talk, art and objecthood, I have said, well, actually, my introduction to Michael was from Manet's sources, which, to, I think, the astonishment of many people dealing with contemporary art, was published as an entire issue of Art Forum in March of 1969, which I read avidly when I was in England and before I came to this country. Manet's sources reappears with an extended commentary on it and its critics in Manet's Modernism, which is Michael's most extended recent publication on Manet, and I'm going to refer to this later on. But I thought to start with, for the benefit of those who perhaps have not seen the exhibition upstairs, that I should just go through quickly the principal works in that exhibition, namely the Maximilian series, and just recap for those who have seen it when they were done and the sequence and what happened. And behind us is the first painting, the painting which is now in the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, which was the artist's first and immediate response to the news of the execution of Maximilian reaching Paris, which it did at the beginning of July of 1867. And it's broadly understood that this picture was certainly part of the art historical influence for the work was the great Goya of the 3rd of May, which is in the Prado, and of which a illustration had been published in Paris the year that this work was created. And that Manet worked on this picture through the spring, and certainly by the autumn, if not earlier, had abandoned it and reconceived the conception of his picture. Can I have the next, please? Number two. Oh, I have a thing here. Yeah. And had changed from the sort of Goya-esque conception to what might be called the Davidian conception. And we will come back to, I think, the role of David's notion of history painting and the frieze-like composition which appears at this point. And really, with this new conception, the sequence of the paintings really develops its momentum. And Manet works on this in the autumn of 67. It's announced for exhibition but is never exhibited, and he sets it aside, and it's in its present fragmented state because Manet cut off some of it himself, and then after his death, other parts were cut off and discarded by his stepson. And the painter Degas brought the pieces together in more or less the same form we see them now. This was itself set aside, and we may to talk about possible reasons for this. And after this, Manet began a lithograph, and he probably began it on the basis of the London painting. But he almost certainly worked on it through the following year for quite an extended time, and it may well not have been completed until after the final work in the series, the great painting at Mannheim. And you can see, and we'll talk about changes which have occurred in the sequence. And then after that comes the oil sketch, which is now in Copenhagen, for the Mannheim painting. And you can see along the bottom edge in particular the marks which Manet put on the painting to form the basis of squaring it up for transfer to the big picture. And this big picture, the work which, with enormous prescience, the small city of Mannheim in Germany, when they founded a museum in 1910, bought this as one of the very first paintings to enter that collection. And it doesn't leave there very often, so we are delighted that we were able to borrow it. And really, it's around, was really on the consequence of that that we started developing the rest of the exhibition. I've deliberately not spoken of the kind of changes which are developing in detail in these pictures, because I want us to come back to these in our conversations. But what I'd like to begin with, if I may, is, Michael, you have looked at these pictures a long time over the years, and certainly in your writing about them, and particularly in Manet's Modernism, where you provide the most extended art historical critical account of these, which deals with the serious issues of these paintings. The strongest account of these since Bataille, you know, which is a long time ago. So you saw them all again this morning, and I just wonder, you know, do you feel differently from what you wrote in Manet's Modernism? What was it like to see them all together?
Yeah. Well, let me first of all say how glad I am to be here. I appreciate the invitation from John. And to have this chance to talk with John about the work. We went through the exhibition this morning. In fact, John, I came here with a group of graduate students and a colleague from Johns Hopkins, from the art history department at Johns Hopkins, and John took us through the show for an hour. And John and I had a little bit of exchange, but really it was wonderful to hear him talk about the pictures. With the great painting in Mannheim, I mean, I'd visited Mannheim on several occasions over decades to see that picture, but you really had to make a pilgrimage to Mannheim to see it. That's, again, what's so extraordinary about having it here. And it's fragile. It doesn't travel lightly. So it's a fantastic opportunity to see it, and to see it on one wall with the London picture, with the Boston first version, with the London fragments, and then the Mannheim picture is extraordinary. Now, it's also the case that I saw the painting this morning having just read, and I mean just read, John's extraordinary catalog book about the paintings. When I say just read, I mean that it arrived yesterday. And yesterday afternoon I taught a class, and last night there was another event at Johns Hopkins. So I read it on the train with a sense of some near hysterical urgency. And it turns out actually to have been a wonderful way to read it, because I may be wrong, but I'm under the impression that right now that I could be tested on it. almost on the footnotes. And I let me just put in this plug. It's an absolutely marvelous publication. It moves the discussion of the Maximilian Project to a completely new level in the Manet literature. And among other things, I mean, it resolves all sorts of historical questions, all sorts of documentary questions, but it also represents a kind of absolutely close and detailed and penetrating and obsessive and invested and hypercharged engagement with the paintings as paintings of a sort that is very, very rarely available, I'd say, in art history, whether in museum catalogs, and this is not a museum catalog, this is a catalog, but it's also a book, or in art history books. So I was reading this, which is also to say, I was looking at the pictures having just gone through, having just saturated myself in John's reading of the pictures. So that I was certainly seeing things that I had not seen before. I had not focused on in my own previous engagement with the paintings. And we'll get to that in a moment. You'll also, discover it in greater detail if you read the catalog and then look at the paintings. For me, let me just do a tiny little bit of scene setting. When I was still an undergraduate interested in art history, and I was an undergraduate at Princeton, and Frank Stella was a close friend and a year older than me, and I knew him from when I was a freshman and he was a sophomore. In our earliest conversations about painting, Manet was the central figure. I think it was for our generation that Manet just loomed. And he seemed utterly important, utterly decisive. For me, to this day, the history of art breaks down into the history of Western painting before the Dejeuner-Soulerbe and the history of Western painting after the Dejeuner-Soulerbe. I can honestly say I became an art historian with the desire to someday understand, but let's just say come to grips with in a sustained way, the Dejeuner-Soulerbe, right? Manet. And Manet, this is also to say that one was very interested in the 1860s, and Manet's breakthrough happens in the early part of the 1860s. But then something happens in 1867, and we can talk about that. And the great monument of that, a kind of renewal of Manet's art, but also a kind of recapitulation of what he'd done earlier and a reinterpretation of what he'd done earlier, is precisely the Maximilian Project. And I did a PhD thesis on Manet's use of sources in the art of the past, his allusions to the art of the past, which is a huge topic that to this day, I would say art history engages with only fitfully, right? Because it's almost embarrassing that the sort of great first modernist artist should be citing so much art of the past, and that certainly happens here, as John's already indicated. And that appeared as a whole issue of Art Forum because Phil Leda, the editor of Art Forum, was an absolute lunatic and wanted to just do this thing. And it, caused a certain amount of understandable consternation. That was March 69. And then quite soon after that, a very distinguished older art historian at Columbia, Theodore Reff, published a piece largely annihilating Manet's sources. And even at the time, I felt the force of the annihilation. At the same time, I felt that this is not necessarily the last word, and I will respond someday dialectically to Reff. It was a very serious piece of writing on Reff's part. It took me about 30 years, but I did finally respond, and the response was the entire book, Manet's Modernism or the Face of Painting in the 1860s, which itself completed a trilogy that began with a book called Absorption and Theatricality, set in the second half of the 18th century in a book called Courbet's Realism. I mean, what I've done is develop an account of the prehistory of modernist painting, culminating in Manet, starting in the middle of the 18th century, crucially involving a set of questions that absolutely come to a head, that are almost literalized, certainly allegorized in the Maximilian pictures, having to do with the relation of paintings to their viewers. The problematic of painting and beholder that starts happening in French painting and starts getting tracked in French art criticism in the 1750s and 60s and works out dialectically through the decades that follow, involving many of the central painters in the French tradition and culminating in a way first with Courbet and then with Manet. And we see that in the Maximilian. My engagement with the Maximinian pictures before today was largely in relation to that whole family of issues. And we can unpack that in further detail. What I had not focused on in my viewings of the Maximinian paintings, and in particular the Mannheim painting, over time, was a whole lot of part of, I would say, like just the actual pictorial texture or fabric of the painting, which John discusses. For example, the kind of figure ground relations that happen in that interval between the nearest of the firing squad persons and the rest of the firing squad. It's funny seeing this the colors off enough.
And it's rather alarming to see a green wall at the back.
John has a brilliant discussion. I'm in the wrong place. Yep. John has a brilliant discussion of this interval, what's happening here, and here. Something that I noticed, entirely consistent with John's attention to the close detail of this painting, that I'd never seen before. I mean, it just wasn't what I was focusing on when I saw this painting in Mannheim or elsewhere. Is look at the level of the ground where it meets the wall. It's almost like Cézanne. I mean, it just doesn't make a straight line. You see, and Manet's letting that stand. And through his whole career, he does things like that. He allows for anomalies. I mean, look at the cast shadow cast by the isolated soldier. I mean, the shadow makes no sense, that kind of crab-like pincer on the ground. And he's also, for whatever reason, made it fainter than the other shadows, whereas in the London fragment, it's as dark as the other. And one's just dealing with this with Manet all the time. There were anomalies and things like this that I did notice, but I was picking up a lot more today because I had just been, I had just read John and had my organs of perception primed in that way.
Well, one thing which we started, I mean, since we're with the Mannheim painting, one thing which we found ourselves talking about briefly this morning was, I forget what your phrase was, Michael, about how strongly one gets invested in certain causality of these pictures, you know, that we, I think, recognized that, you know, that Manet was a person of extraordinary pictorial intelligence and, you know, who had, you know, thought through every aspect of this picture at some level of his mind, and in some cases simply by the process we know of his peculiar actual method of working, which involved, by all accounts, first of all, coating the canvas with oil and then wiping it off so that it allowed a very swift attack and the brush could move quickly and you could get images down quickly. And then when they didn't work, wiping them off and doing them again. And there is a report of a sitter of one portrait who claimed that there were 30 different faces on this portrait before Manet left it. And in that process, obviously, is a sort of learning about the picture so that when the image goes down and is satisfying to him, it's, you know, it's actually hard to disentangle the kind of causal links that produce it. But, you know, art historians, being art historians, want to invest themselves in certain reasons for these. And in the catalog, I describe the changes. I'll just go back to London, that one can see how this unit between the first soldier and the squad is treated with this particular silhouette. And by the time it gets, and that unit is more or less maintained in the lithograph and in the oil sketch. But when we get to the Mannheim painting, we see what has happened is that he has actually precised it far more, I mean, as with all of them, but he's also actually turned it, so it turns left, in a way, in a sort of reinforcement of the movement from right to left. And also, as Michael added this morning as I was saying that, that Manet is, no matter how much he opens his groups, he's always closing them at the same time. There's always some connection, as with on the right, where the handle of the musket just touches the figure next to it. So in the catalogue, my argument of causality was that he wanted to shape that space in that way, and therefore, in order to do it, reduced the height of the soldier to the left. It was when the exhibition, when the painting arrived in the exhibition, and I was looking at it, it dawned on me in a way in which, although I had seen it a number of times in Mannheim, and of course a lot in reproduction, it had never quite registered that the diminution of that figure makes this person look rather like a child soldier. And as it happened yesterday, I was talking to an artist, Bridget Riley, in the galleries, who said to me, well, of course, we know that from our recent history of child soldiers in conflicts, that they're actually capable of more acts of violence than people who have, you know, more adult memories. So then the question is, did in fact Manet set about reducing this figure to be a child and then find himself doing the change of the contouring, or the other way around? And in the end, I think one comes out that, there are intentions which are not conscious, but which have become part of a pictorial practice like this, and that he actually did want both of them, or at least he is responsible for whatever gets into the picture.
Let me even generalize John's point slightly about Manet. If we go back 30 or 40 years, and this would even include Bataille, though that's a very, very, very high-level book, as you know, short book, there was a kind of simple version of Manet, which, you know, is still at large, and it sees Manet as the first modernist painter. And in some sense, that's not wrong, but it has to be complicated and dialectalized in a lot of ways. I mean, that is to say, I would want to argue that modernism begins in a modernist painting begins in a complicated structure that goes Courbet-Manet-Impressionism, in which the Courbet term gets activated retrospectively by Courbet, by Manet, and Manet himself gets interpreted and in many ways simplified by Impressionism. And the simplified version of Manet that in some ways prevails to this day, but certainly was very, very dominant, was that Manet began modernist painting by making painting go flat. And that one of the great characteristic of Manet's art was something like the foregrounding, the presentation of flatness, and that the hidden story of modernist painting was something like a kind of inadvertent drive towards flatness and struggle with flatness. At its absolute highest level, this is the account of the critic Clement Greenberg. But it was also, I think, very widely shared in the academic world, and to some extent might be to this day. I think, in all sorts of ways, that account is fundamentally wrong. Flatness is absolutely wrong, I think, as a reading of Manet, certainly as a historically subtle reading of Manet. And one of the wonderful things about John's book is I think the term flat and flatness doesn't appear in it practically. which again, marks a certain date. Now, what's wrong with it? What's wrong with flatness? Well, again, if you go at Manet and try... If you're a historian, and I'm an art critic, but I'm also crucially an art historian, the kind of understanding that I would want of any artist, but let's say in this case Manet, would be to try to understand what Manet is doing as much as I can in the terms that would be operative for him and in his world, whether or not those were terms that he was consciously employing. I agree completely mm-hmm. with John's mm-hmm. account. Unconscious intention. There's no problem about talking about intentions with artists, and there's no problem in principle or philosophically about talking about unconscious intentions. You may be right or you may be wrong in your account of these, but you are absolutely legitimately entitled to go after them and to try to nail them. One way of trying to understand Manet that was crucial to me, and this is in this case, my project was different from John's in this, but John's book engages, I have to say, extraordinarily generously with my work. This is not something that is common in art history. It was one of the things that kept me going through that. It mitigated my desperation as I read the book. I'm simply not used to that level of generosity. But for me, part of the project of understanding Manet involved seeing Manet as a member of a generation. A member of a generation. Courbet was born in 1819. The Impressionists were born, I'm simplifying now, around 1840. Manet is born between those two generations in 1832. The other members of his generation are, to some extent, Degas, Fantin-Latour, an extraordinary artist named Alphonse Le Gros, in a certain sense Whistler, before he leaves France and goes to England. And there are critics associated with that generation. And if you see Manet, if you make an effort to study those artists in the late 50s and early 60s, and you saturate yourself in the art criticism of the period, this is something that earlier art historians of modernity didn't do. One of the things that we have going for us is a fantastic, enormous, rich body of art criticism. Say something about that in relation to the Maximilian pictures. When the Salon took place, the big exhibition every year, every other year, there were scores of newspapers in Paris. And every one of them had an art critic who wrote accounts of those salons. The accounts themselves were called salons. So there's tons of stuff to read. And if you take that seriously, and I think in terms of studying this kind of painting, this is an oversimplification, but I think I and T.J. Clark were the sort of first critics to come, the first art historians to come along who really felt that critical material was a gold mine and who read through a tremendous amount of it. You can start to reconstruct the actual terms of the discussion around the painting, around the advanced painting, at a given time, in this case, the early 1860s. And one of what emerges, I want to say, in the painting that we're talking about here, but also the criticism, is that two notions come to the fore, and neither one of them is flatness. One of them is facingness. Right? The paintings of Manet and his generation not only face the viewer in some new, more aggressive, more foregrounded way, but are felt to do so by the people looking at them, by the critics, and the critics are very uncomfortable with this. They can't understand why a painting should make a point of its facingness that way. And the other term that emerges, quite fascinatingly, again and again and again, when they're talking about Manet and the others, and again, they feel ambivalent about this, is strikingness. Strikingness. And if you look at something like the Maximilian pictures and think about this in terms not of some kind of just overall flatness, which is, I think, simply not at stake, but a thematization of facingness, the firing squad facing Maximilian and the two generals and Maximilian facing the firing squad, a kind of strikingness that's obviously going on as they are being executed. The painting itself, in a certain sense, facing us, striking us in its very sharp simplifications and contrasts and so on. You start to get into, you can actually start to get your own perceptions, your own responses to the painting. You can start to inflect them and shape them in the direction of, towards the terms of, the discussion of the period. I take that to be part of one's project as someone trying to understand these pictures historically. Now, I won't go on at too great length, but it's also to say what we're trying to do is replace, what one wants to do is replace a kind of simple version of Manet with a much more complex version of Manet. But one of the things that you become aware of as you start to do this is that Manet is really, really, really complex and really deep. And that any set of terms for understanding him that you set up, any set of categories, any reading that you construct, any hermeneutic, any interpretation, and one, that's what you have to try to do. That's the project. If you're not doing that, you just get out of the kitchen. But he escapes it. He breaks it. He cannot be captured. There's something in him that resists. Just as he resisted being found completely intelligible by the critics of his times. On the one hand, he was dying to receive the Legion of Honor. He wanted a gold medal. But he didn't really. He didn't really. I mean, if he'd really wanted that, he would not have painted the Déjeuner Célèbre. This would look different. There was something in him that resisted assimilation, that resisted understanding, that resisted coherence, that resisted... I mean, let me see if I can get near the screen. Well, no, I don't need to get there. I can do it with this. I mean, when you go see this picture, I mean, and we may talk more about this tonight, there's the question of, in this whole series of pictures, of someone who is called the sword officer. When a firing squad took place, there was an officer who had a sword who ordained the moment when the squad fired, either by raising the sword or by lowering the sword. Anyway, he did something with the sword, and that told the men in the squad when to shoot. That figure, in terms of these paintings, wore a red kepi. And we see just a trace of that red kepi back here. And as you follow this project through, and John discusses this in detail in his catalog, Manet keeps being of separate minds about the sword officer. We could even go back for a moment and see.
Let's go back to the start.
To where we can really... Right, here, there's only the sense of...
Yeah, the little...
That little, see the little red kepi there? Just the little red
further
touch.
Further down, Michael, isn't it? Yeah, just up there.
Yeah. So he's hidden here, and let's go to the next. But there's the sword. There's the sword, which is giving the signal to fire. Here, Manet's pulled him out and put the sword up there. He's sort of like a Civil War colonel, signaling a charge. Here, in the Copenhagen sketch, we see him again. And then, in the final version, Manet has eliminated the sword, eliminated the gesture completely. And I think John agrees.
Just interject that at one point, the figure was painted in the gap between the squad and the sergeant. And then Manet eliminated him and, in effect, went back to the London solution, but without the sword.
Without the sword. And now, with the red kepi marked a bit more. And then, and you can, I mean, there's a whole question, what's at stake? What's going on in that? And I think John and I agree crucially about one aspect of it. I mean, what I felt was that if there were the sword, if there were some kind of powerful thematization of that figure and giving the signal, that would locate the agency of the execution in that figure, and the others are simply following on. If we minimize that, I mean, virtually eliminate that, then the agency gets diffused through the whole picture, and the sense of some kind of mechanical inevitability is much stronger and also much more widely dispersed through the picture. But typically of Manet, characteristically of Manet, he doesn't do away with it completely. He gives us that tiny bit of kepi. And I mean, think of what a strange thing that is to do. It's so slight, it barely reads. It's not as if what you can't say is, well, he realized he needed a little accent of red at that point. If he needed an accent of red at that point, he needed a bigger kepi. It's something else. He wants to signal that there's something there. And then most astonishing, and when you go to see the painting, it's so Manet, that's all I can say. There's a red streak of paint put down there. The red is a marker of the sword officer. But it's just a streak of paint. it absolutely and totally resists being assimilated to depiction or to representation. It's as if Manet simultaneously feels utterly compelled to all but completely eliminate the sword officer, and at the same time put in this marker of the sword officer's vestigial presence, his having been there, his necessity. And it's some sort of very, it becomes a very personal marker. It's as if it's Manet, his mark. Because ultimately, right, the agency, the agent behind this painting is Manet. Or there are a number of agents. There are a number of agents, including Napoleon III. But one agent, one truly indispensable agent, is Manet. And that is his mark. But it's also a mark that resists intelligibility, resists assimilation. I mean, if Manet, if he really wanted the Legion of Honor, he'd take that out. Right? That's not designed to make potentially hostile critics happy. Oh, fantastic, we're giving a free-floating piece of streak of red between the legs. You know, no. I mean, and even, you know, and it's not as if you can assimilate that even and say, well, it's impressionist painterliness, avant la lettre. No, it's not impressionist painterliness. It's some kind of completely perverse, unintelligible, resistant insistence on a red streak. Okay? That's Manet. That's Manet. And it's something that anyone dealing with Manet is dealing with all the time. And it's you can feel it quite personally. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's as if he's saying, yeah, you can work as hard as you want on me, and in one sense I totally appreciate it. But but you aren't going to get me. You aren't going to get me. There's always going to be something like this. There's going to be that red streak, and you can just make guesses about it. Mm-hmm.
And maybe we'll come to this later with the Dead Christ with Angels. It really is the Christ's left hand and the feet, which contain elements which absolutely, one can argue forever, and one will never actually find some depictive justification. Absolutely. For these. Conversely, there are other elements where, one actually can argue for a reason for it and perhaps cling unreasonably to that reason because you get so invested in it.
Yes, that's another. I mean, on the one hand, you want to resist all the going simplifications and you want to appreciate the complexity of Manet's pictorial imagination and his practices. But then as you start to work out your private version of this complexity, you start to realize that you might be slightly crazy. Anyone who's read me knows a lot of instances. I mean, I see references to previous art that, I have to say, have not achieved universal agreement. Let's put it that way. And there's a sort of wonderful moment in John's book where he's talking about the bright blue plumage of the angels in the Dead Christ with Angels upstairs. And John had gone to Mexico and he'd seen a fantastic, what, Montezuma's headdress, yeah, with blue peacock feathers. And as I read that in the book, I thought, uh-oh.
Another crazy person.
I know it. I see it happening. Yeah. And yet, I mean, here's the thing. John says that, but he actually thinks that those feathers have to do with Montezuma's headdress. And I have exactly the same kinds of obsessions. Manet does this to us. Mm-hmm. I mean, somewhere he's laughing. But better that, I have to say, than better the obsession of certain kinds of historians who are dedicated to the proposition that Manet is an extraordinarily difficult and complex artist, than a kind of normalization of Manet, so that the strangeness of the pictures. I mean, and this is something that art history specializes in. In a way, it's inevitable. It's inevitable as an artist gets worked on and gets, made the subject of more and more dissertations. The artist becomes more and more assimilated to the norms of art history. So that, for example, just recently, an artist, a very distinguished art historian, talking about the dead torero, which is upstairs. I mean, from the fragment cut from the incident in a bullfight of 1864, but the torero lying there with his hand on his chest and a tiny little bit of blood on the ground, treats it as simply a kind of impressive and moving image of death, with no sense whatever of the strange, call it theatricality of that figure. Is that figure really dead? Is the figure just posing to be dead? That whole complicated problematic in Manet of the status of the actions in his paintings. This is in a very, the Maximilian Project is itself extremely unusual in that it is depicting something that indubitably took place. Mm-hmm. It is depicting a clear action. So if you think of something like the Déjeuner Célèbre, it's not at all clear what the action is that that's depicting. But Manet finds other ways of distancing us from this. So on the one hand, one wants to understand Manet. On the other hand, one doesn't want to have that understanding lead to a kind of new normal. Manet is not a normal painter. Right? Manet is what, you know, maybe the most resistant, the most, in the end, as it were, unintelligible figure that I know in the history of painting. It's as if, it's fantastic. I mean, at this turning point for modernity, this crucial hinge figure for modernism, should not be. Matisse says of him at one point, brilliant Matisse. Matisse says, Manet was born to simplify painting, and in a way, let us then paint by our instincts. And that's wrong. Manet's own practice was this extraordinarily complex thing that is anything but simple. It just isn't simple. But what the Impressionists made of Manet, that's where the simplification took place. That's even where the flatness came in. And Matisse, who revered Manet, is the inheritor of the Impressionists' version of Manet. Now, so constantly the way art itself, painting itself, keeps reinterpreting its own past. And one of the things that modernist painting itself did, that advanced painting did, was simplify Manet. Our project is to get back to Manet. Manet, you might say, before Impressionism, before Matisse, before what Manet led to. And when we get there in our respective ways, what we discover is just extraordinarily complex and difficult, and then that leads to us projecting like hell. Yeah.
I think both an encouragement to projection and an impediment to an understanding of these pictures is that they were not exhibited, of course, in Manet's lifetime, because Napoleon III would not allow it. And therefore, the kind of salon criticism.
We have no criticism.
We have nothing.
We have no criticism. It would have been so interesting. I mean, this picture would have received extensive discussion by numbers of critics, many, many of whom who were really, really interesting. And we don't have a word about these pictures from this moment.
Yep. And I think it becomes, one thing which one particularly regrets because they are describing events that really had taken place and which the audience would be expected to know about. And one thing we were talking about briefly this morning was how by isolating the sergeant on the right-hand side of the picture, and this figure is the one who will deliver the coup de grace to Maximilian after the firing squad has failed to kill him. And insofar as really he is the figure inside the picture with whom I think we are asked to identify ourselves by Manet, by his isolation, by his seriousness, a certain amount of thinking going on in this figure, which is not visible, a sort of exception to the automatism of everything else. Also by the fact that our shadow is cast at his feet. contemporary viewers of the painting, if there had been any, would have known that, in fact, what this man had to do was pretty horrible, which is to, we know that it took at least two shots by this man reloading his musket in the middle of them to actually manage to dispatch the poor Maximilian. So what does it mean for us to be asked to have an identification with this particular figure? And I think that it's something which carries all the way through the painting. And one thing which I know was particularly important to me in Michael's account of this picture was at one point where he talks about the whole issue of strikingness in the work of Manet and the relation of this to the kind of depiction of instantaneity, of something happening at an instant, which can actually help to tease out this notion of strikingness. And that obviously if there were ever something which would be thought to be instantaneous, it would be an execution like this. But in fact, it wasn't. And and I think that what is actually fascinating about following the series of the pictures, particularly from London through to this one, is that Manet seemed to gradually tease out of himself that what he's doing is trying to both depict the instantaneousness of this and also reveal, as I think I won't attempt to quote directly what Michael had said, but effectively represent the fiction of instantaneousness as well. And in this picture, among different ways, the smoke, for example, that the smoke that is clustering, the darker smoke which is clustering around the figure of Mejia, which is now, the smoke which is going up the wall is a little later. This figure is a little later still. And while, as Manet was reading the different newspaper reports, he was effectively being told regularly about the instant, about the event, and being told more and more about the changed circumstances, what the soldiers were wearing and things of that sort. And through London, you know, these things seemed to be of interest to him. But I think that he got to a certain point and realized, actually, that it wasn't, you know, changes of uniforms and so on would get him so far. What he had to engage with, finally, was the temporal dimension of this picture. And I think that, you know, this opens onto wider issues, both in terms of the later representations of violent subjects by photography, which later photography able to represent the instantaneous moment, but not easily able to represent the instantaneous moment and the duration. And that by the time that Manet has created this picture, he is actually placing the shock, the moment of impact, within a certain kind of temporal dimension, which is, in a way, the beginning of placing it in history. And I think that, you know, as we think of the possibility of how horrific events can be actually moved into history or made tragic, to put it another way, you know, that clearly we understand that they require representation to do this, because it won't happen otherwise without acts of representation. And that the tradition of pictorial representation is the tradition of representing sudden moments. And this is, you know, most, you know, famously described by Lessing and by Diderot about this is what painting uniquely can do. And in a way, it provides the context for Manet. But, you know, Manet is not satisfied with context. He wants to push this and wants to actually find a way of representing the kind of sequentiality of what happens, wants to allow an event to become a sort of shared responsibility by opening it from that moment.
Another way of thinking of this really very tricky issue of temporality and painting in the Western tradition, in the easel painting tradition, is to realize that simply as the kind of artifact that an easel painting is. It has a double and, in a way, contradictory relation to issues of temporality. As an artifact, as a made thing, it doesn't change. It just stays. It's pure stasis, pure duration. And painting can and often does thematize that, emphasize that. In the tradition that Manet is coming out of, from Diderot in the middle of the 18th century on, that's carried, for example, by motifs of what I call absorption. Figures absorbed in doing something, in reading a book, in building a card castle, as in Chardin, in performing physical labor, in being in a firing squad. I mean, those soldiers doing that, that's not an instantaneous action. This is not just a split-second take on that. We're to understand that as held. And that lines up with, that subtly underscores and is underscored by the unchangingness of the painting. At the same time, a painting, an easel painting, is something that the viewer can, in effect, take in as a whole, in a flash. Right? That's part of the point of an easel painting. That's the difference between an easel painting and, let's say, a decorative ensemble, fresco, ceilings, and so on. Manet, characteristically, is involved. The temporal mode that is most characteristic of Manet is that instance of impact. Manet is finding ways of thematizing the way in which a painting can seem, can be felt, to give itself over to the viewer in a single flash. And that's what's at stake in the facingness and the strikingness. But what is depicted in the picture is going to be always in some tension with that instantaneous giving over. And the painting itself is not thereby made into just an instantaneous artifact. It is not just a lightning flash. Manet's paintings come as close to being lightning flashes as any paintings in the history of art. But they're not. They stay there. They hang on the wall. They're up there even as we're down here talking. And they haven't moved, you know, since they were made. Not inside themselves. So what one ends up with is very, very complex structures of unmovingness and nevertheless thematization of something like instantaneousness and strikingness, which is certainly something going on in the depicted action of this picture itself. Where John and I probably differ relative to what he just said is I'm much less confident that I know that I identify with him, or that I identify anywhere. There's a way in which Manet's paintings, for me, are so counter-identificatory with respect to the viewer that I never feel I'm, as it were, going in and being him or her. Or so. I'm always being kept at a distance. And so for me, the issue in this picture, as you know, would be less where I or identify as viewer than where Manet, as the painting's maker, but also the painting's first viewer, Manet as painter-beholder, where he identifies. And I think that what he's done is create an ensemble where he is, as I put it in my book, everywhere and nowhere. I mean, he is with Maximilian and the others, being assaulted by the critics, being assaulted by the public. But he is also quite aware that his paintings have an assaultive, striking, aggressing character. That if people don't like him, it's the paintings are fighting back on their own terms or even instigating this in the first place. So he is also with the firing squad. And he is certainly with that figure at the right. I mean, one almost inadvertent pun that's going on. What the figure who gives the coup de grace is called to do is to finish. To finish the job. And if there is one thing that even sympathetic critics have been begging Manet to do for 7 years, and are going to beg him to do till he dies, and he will not do it, it's finish his pictures. Right? Will you finish the picture? And when you look at this picture, I mean, this is really, I mean, it's astonishing the level of unfinish in that hand.
I mean, but just sort of everywhere. And that becomes then just like the ne plus ultra of unfinished. Something else that you'll see in this painting, which goes through Manet's whole career, I mentioned this when we were walking through this morning, is there's a point in Manet's career where critics are finally, they haven't come round to him, but they're aware that he's been in the arena, that he's been heroic, that he's just sent his pictures to the Salon year after year. If they get rejected, he sends them back the next year. He's just, you know, indomitable. And they don't really like the pictures, but they want to give him something. And what they end up saying is something like, if you would just give your figures fingernails, you know, we will do the following. And basically Manet is saying, fingernails? No way. You know, no way. And there are no fingernails. I mean, what's it? Picasso at one point says there are no feet in nature. There are no fingernails in Manet. Mm-hmm. So that whole issue of finish is there. So what I'm feeling is Manet, and then Manet in The Sword Officer, Manet as the all but eliminated agent, but who nevertheless insists not just on his active presence, but his active presence as this almost unintelligible force. So I'm less able to go to any single place than to feel that I'm as it were being moved everywhere, and that Manet's art is also so crucially about, and this is going to become its own kind of modernist trope. I mean, it's going to be eventually, let's say by the time we get to Pollock, the equivalent of a kind of all-overness. The way in which Manet wants to sustain a certain kind of pictorial and even intellectual intensity across the entire expanse of a picture. Right? That there shouldn't be a place to go, you know, a place, a focus. You're constantly moved and displaced and kept in a certain sense unsatisfied. This would be a nuanced disagreement between us. But there's no arguing in a funny way. There's no arguing with either one of us. That is to say, if I'm saying, well, this is what how it is, I mean. Oh, that's where I am. And if I can't tell John, you know, no, you shouldn't be invested in the guy about to deliver the coup de grace. It doesn't make sense. Yeah.
Now, I had, Jennifer Field, who was one of the people who worked with Anna Swinburne, who were sitting next to each other, who worked on the exhibition, said to me, you're going to run over. And I said, no, we'll have plenty of time for questions. And we are moving on. So perhaps we should actually invite questions at this point and see where we go. And we could, how much longer do you think we could go, Laura?
10 or 15 minutes.
Okay, so if there are anyone who wants to ask questions, there's a microphone here, or maybe there could be one passed, or if you can project.
I have a microphone here, I'll pass it up. I'd like to ask a question about the dislocation of the viewer. John, you mentioned that directly above your head there's a shadow on the ground, which could be interpreted as the shadow of the viewer looking into the picture. But the light source of that shadow is entirely different than the light source of the shadows cast by the figures in the picture, which dislocates you in the way that Michael says he can't find that entrance point into it. Is it the intent of Manet to dislocate the viewer in the picture?
Well, I think indeed, you know, all of the shadows are there's no consistency with all the shadows. It isn't simply that one is inconsistent with the rest. All the other ones are inconsistent. And I do think that there is within the picture, not only through the shadows, but through a lot of the pictorial incident. I mean, particularly the treatment of the belts and the spats, for example, that, you know, he keeps you off balance, you know, and the very fact that the difficulty talking about Manet generally, and particularly about this painting, is one finds oneself making unconscious puns about the pictures. And then when I said off balance, you notice that two of the soldiers actually are off balance, that they have a foot lifted off the ground. You know, and in a way, you know, that, is this accidental? Of course it's not accidental. And there is this sort of element of things not only being created but being allegorized in these pictures. And actually, I think of in the end that perhaps I'm less looking at the picture, identifying with of this person than he's identifying with me. Mm-hmm. You know, that I'm not going to step into the picture. He's going to step out of it mm-hmm. and walk around the front and try to do the finishing from an impossible position. Mm-hmm.
In a way, Michael Fried's already answered this question, but it's something that I've been really interested in for quite some time. There was a statement made by Thierry Dudov in the 80s. It was
In
the 80s, sorry, oh, okay. In response to an exhibition by Luke Timmons. And what he was saying was that there was a path that Manet didn't choose in the 1860s. Which, if it had been followed and also if it had been attended to, would have resulted in his direct heir being somebody like Jeff Wall. And I suppose I'm asking for a comment on the statement, not necessarily in relation to Jeff Wall as an heir of that trajectory, but just about the thing that sort of interests me, I suppose, is the idea of the alternate trajectory.
Do you want to...
Michael is the best person to be speaking about Jeff Wall, but let me say that, you know, I do think that, you know, certainly my experience of early modern works are that there are constantly, and I think actually in this case, I share Manet's view on this, which is that this, you know, as we recognize something which looks like a continual progressive movement to, you know, which shapes the history of painting and pictorial art forward, which is true. At the same time, we find certain movements which are actually so quick that they'll leave whole avenues open, and that just as Manet is going back to mine the past and finding this purchase on works of art and coaxing from them possibilities which their artists perhaps never thought about. So the whole history of early modernism is full of this. And I think that certainly that now to look back at these pictures of the 1860s is to see the real force of a narrative art, and then think forward about what happened to that force. And I think inevitably one is now looking back on it from a position of new photography in a way in which is very different from what one would have been looking at it from. Well, so, you know, when you started to write about Manet, I mean, it's, you know, I think that there is that certain, you know, that aspect certainly is there.
Let me,
I don't think it's only Manet.
Yeah, the way I would then just supplement what John said is I don't quite, knowing Thierry as well as I do, the thought of disagreeing with him publicly terrifies me because I know that the word will reach him and then he will want to talk about it, and he's prepared to talk about it for years. And I'm in the end not. But I can't quite get the idea of an alternative line of development. In other words, it's the line of development that we've had that gives us Jeff Wall. Now, Jeff Wall is not an alternative to the line of development we've had. It's been the dialectical unpacking of everything, including high modernism, including Pollock, including Newman, including all of that art, without which there could be no Jeff Wall, as Jeff Wall himself would insist, right? That gives us, at a certain moment in time, starting in the late 70s, given the technology then available and the particular state of the question within modernism, minimalism, conceptualism, and after, and photography, that led Jeff Wall and others to do what they did. And what that then does is, again, by a kind of reverse dialectic, sort of by a kind of what Freud called Nachträglichkeit, make available a kind of re-seeing and rethinking and reframing of that earlier art. But Wall himself, you must remember, Wall himself thinks like a modernist. Wall himself would not regard what happened after Manet and before Wall as some sort of incorrect path. Right? He's far too historical himself to do that. It was the unpacking. It wasn't as if there was some, if only what artists had been different, there could have been a whole tradition of great socially oriented figural depiction from Manet to the present. No, that was just not in the cards. That could not have happened. If you look at, say, certain paintings by Kaya Bott, you'll see it's about as good as anyone could do at that time, and those are impressive paintings. And there are even moments in Seurat's figure paintings and so on and so forth. But the idea that there could have been some mainline, powerful, dialectical development artistically just as distinguished as the one that took place that could have led to Jeff Wall, A, it couldn't have happened. B, it wouldn't have led to Jeff Wall. It's what happened that led to Jeff Wall. Having said that, please don't tell Thierry that I said it.
I was curious about the kind of intra-development of the Maximilian project. And forgive me, I haven't finished reading the catalog essay, so I think you're... The catalog touches on this, but maybe more extensively than I'd realized. The Boston picture has a kind of diagonal axial movement from the right side, shooting the squad shoots diagonally back to the upper, higher on the left, and that seems to me kind of uncharacteristic in some ways of Manet's compositions. And then in the London picture, Manet moves back to a kind of horizontal, frieze-like shape of the overall canvas and of the shooting movement. In some ways, almost like the burial at Ornon, this very long mountain in the background and this horizontal movement. And then with the Mannheim picture, it seems that the sum of the diagonal axis returns, but the wall in the background enforces a kind of horizontality again. And what we get is, in some ways, a kind of a compromise between the two earlier schemes.
I think one way to actually represent this in another way, could we go to number 7? One before. You know, that it begins with Goya, you know, and that clearly this is the inspiration for the Boston painting. both in the... in this spatial dislocation between the soldiers and the victims, as well as the general painterliness. And then, next please, he goes to David for the London painting. I mean, this is a kind of crude explanation of something which is obviously, you know, the other question is, so why does he go to David at this point? What is unsatisfactory about the Boston approach? As you may know, for a long time, the Boston painting has been diminished and thought of as merely a sketch. But I think that, and this is something which Michael touched on earlier, that one of the things which is so remarkable about Manet is the range of his pictorial practice. And I think one, needs to be, absolutely confident before dismissing anything as unfinished. And that this was actually carried through. And I think, one could argue that, thinking about how he was going to represent this event, he thought about Goya, and he...
But I don't see the connection you're making. In other words, the diagonality of the kind of recessive quality of the Boston painting, I don't see in either the Goya or the David. Do you?
Well, I don't see it in the David. No, I'm saying that he turns to the David for London.
Oh,
okay. Yeah.
But what's at stake in the diagonality? Why does he want that, and why does he want to leave it?
Well, I think it's clear he wanted. One thing we can certainly infer that he wanted to leave it. But maybe can we go back to Boston? The Boston one, which I think is the first one. So, I mean, one of the complications of this picture, I think, is that we do make judgments about it on the basis of what follows, including the fact that there are three victims, you know, which we can't, in fact, say for certain. And, I think that it's, in fact, I feel that a good argument could be made that one of the reasons it's abandoned is that he set the victims too far away from the squad. You know, that he missed that intimate relationship between the two, and that, you know, I don't think he was necessarily thinking of a diagonality, but it was, you know, something which developed in the actual creation of this picture, which he came to feel was actually a wrong way of doing it. But one element which is actually, you know, when you say he comes back to it, I think that one element in which he comes back to it is in the, that he retreats the figures in the Mannheim painting further back than the London painting, and therefore ends up with this curious sense that, in fact, the execution squad is missing the figures. And, you know, which I think is part of the complexity of that last painting, which is something which it takes a while to appear to you. Here, the painterliness actually disguises any true sense of causality. It's actually very hard to make out what kind of narrative one, you know, that in a way it requires a certain clarity to have a narrative which is complicated. And I think at this point he clearly is not doing it.
Let me take another shot at that question. We're speculating now. We're in the realm of, you know, pure speculation. But my own hunch would be that when he started thinking about this, what led to the Boston picture having the structure that you're referring to was the idea of presenting the three figures, even if we can't be sure there are three here, but the three figures being executed as near as possible facing the viewer. Could we go for a minute just very briefly to number 9, please? No, number 9. This is 10. Yeah. So, God, PowerPoint really does produce the most ghastly color since chromolithography, I have to say. I will never give up slides. They will just last my career. But every so often I feel like it's justified not just by my own technological incompetence, but by what the things actually look like. So as Frank Stella once said of a painting of his in a reproduction, he said, "It's a nice painting, but I haven't painted it yet." but here, this is the Old Musician in the National Gallery of 1862. And it's a painting that is, I think, a real template for Manet's vision. And these figures basically lined up these two, and this is the Gilles figure from Watteau, this is a figure from Spanish art. There's that sombrero on the Gilles figure that's going to come back in the Maximilian painting. The idea of this blondish figure with a darkish Spanish type is going to come back absolutely in the general standing with Maximilian. I also ask you to notice, John talks about this, the cut-off figure at the right, just something of this feel. Also, notice that strange lost profile perdu. That's going to turn up again and again and again in all the figures in the firing squad, right? The way they're turned away from us. And it's going to be a very Manet use of the profil perdu. Typically, the profil perdu, you could think of Watteau as an example for this, creates a kind of almost aching emotional feeling. You have a sense of a beautiful face just turned away from you. You just can't quite see it. In Manet, not a bit of it. It's just the profile is lost, and you don't even think for a minute that there's a face the other side of that profile. Right? It's part of the particular kind of deadpan mereness that Manet wants, and that, again, puts viewers off, frustrates viewers. They're dying to give themselves to the painting, to sort of experience the profil perdu as this figure for something, that an elusive beauty, and Manet's not going to have it. Now can we go back to the Boston picture, please.
Which is number one.
I mean, there's the cutoff figure at the right and a facing figure there. But what he's trying, what he wanted to do, I think, was kind of thematize the, have as much as possible, have us directly, have the viewer directly face the people being executed. Therefore, the firing squad is going to be seen very largely from the rear. And then he doesn't, then that would end up with something that was too much facing versus rear. So he puts a facing figure here, which perhaps detaches him too much from the firing squad. This is going to be the one who's going to deliver the coup de grace. And then, in a typical Manet way, in order to establish that kind of overall continuity across the kind of picture field, let's put it that way, has this figure cut off at the edge, again, coming out of the old musician. So Manet is very much in dialogue with his own past. I think what he comes to see is, as brilliant in a way as this is, the ultimate impracticality of that as a solution. And could we then now go back, let's say, to the Mannheim version? What he ends up with is this very complex, you could say, compromise structure, where on the one hand, he's lateralized it, a la David, but still found a way to give us something like, something approaching frontal access to that group. But of course, that leads to the kind of consequences and aporias, let's say, that Manet's art is full of, as these rifles in some way miss, right, fire in the lateral plane, and if we really take that literally, might well miss Mejia, even as he's grimacing, as the bullets ostensibly are shooting to him. So Manet is engaged with this kind of struggle, I think, all the way through. That would be my way.
And I think in that sense that, you know, I would read the Boston painting as not about a diagonal structure, but rather about planes arranged, the one on the left representing the victims, in plane with the soldiers, in plane with the figure. And I think him realizing that he wanted to get away from this sort of theater flat-like form. And really, what he's playing with in the post-London studies and then this, I think, is this wonderful invention of this big triangular structure, which is the three victims, really, as one sort of big composite figure. And just as the squad is a composite figure where you can't actually match up how many heads and how many legs, but it's like it's become some new kind of thing, which I think adds to the automatism of it because it doesn't quite seem human. While one can count everything, you know, in the other one, there still is this sort of counterpoint by this amazing plane which he's playing with in terms of actually, they're dropping in a big diagonal at the left-hand side of the picture.
That would have driven critics crazy. I mean, all of that.
Yeah. I'm coming from a quite different place and different time, namely returning from London, where I was involved with the opening of a Velázquez exhibition, no stranger to Manet. And what strikes me about this exhibition, actually I saw the 92-93 one in London, so I've seen these paintings together before, is the extraordinary evidence of the work of making. And of course, when you see Velázquez, the work is effaced. You do not see it. And that is a stunning difference. I'm not talking about modernism. I'm less, as a 17th century person and specialist, I'm less engaged with the difference, but with the continuity, which clearly, Velázquez resembles Manet, right? They're part of the same scheme, seen one way or seen my way. But the amount of work that's on those walls that is evidenced compared to the kind of courtly grace with which Velázquez can get away without showing it to you. And so opening up, which is extraordinary, coming from Velázquez in the National Gallery and following that painting, which I suppose Samara Smith brought over to or came to celebrate to this, that's absolutely extraordinary to me. That's himself.
Yeah, I think that's completely right. I mean, Velázquez never let anybody see him sweat. Which is also to say that the power of Velázquez's pictorial illusionism, I mean, the way in which he's able to acknowledge the medium everywhere, but at the same time establish such a powerful and persuasive mode of illusionism so that he can put an entire huge horse in the Surrender at Breda, you know, and you completely accept it. You completely accept it, that there's this huge horse in that picture, and then that you're going back to this remote distance. That's just no longer, you know, it's just no longer an option, right? Painting has evolved in some way where that's just out of the question by the 1860s. Hell, it's out of the question by the 1780s. It's probably out of the question by 1700. So that's part of the story, and part of it is the illusionism that is just no longer available. But then, yes, Manet is constantly that whole thematics of touch and execution, and also this thing that we've been talking about, this compulsion in Manet to not let the thing seem seamless. I mean, there are just going to be so many seams, so many points of resistance, so many points of unassimilatableness, and so on. So something like the Mannheim picture is amazing from that point of view. I mean, you could imagine someone making the argument still to this day that, you know, it's not finished. But of course, he signed it. It's finished.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, I mean, obviously, the one painting in the exhibition which calls up Velázquez's name most is the Dead Toreador. You know, and you know, recalls what Manet had said about Velázquez when he was in Spain about the great portrait of the actor, and saying that, you know, it's amazing he's standing on the ground, but the whole thing is smoke. You know, and that obviously, you know, Manet brings back from Spain something of this, which is clearly a big imperative in his single figure pictures in the period before this.
Right. And between 65 and 67. Yeah.
And yet when you see something close to this ambition in the Dead Toreador, and there's no way, as you say, you're going to mistake this for a Velázquez. I mean, you know, that... And yet the same miracle which he describes about the Velázquez is actually true about the Manet. But it's in a way where the coarseness of the means, you know, which is spoken so much by subsequent artists, is something which Manet is clearly the example for, you know, for the future.
And he's an inheritor of Courbet here. I mean, I think this is why Courbet can never be forgotten in this sort of complex hinge-like structure of the beginning of modernism, because on the one hand, Courbet is this very, very powerful realist, but also someone working in the material of painting so powerfully and so frankly and so masterfully that no ambitious painting after Courbet, in the wake of Courbet, and of course Courbet at this moment is still alive and still and painting beautifully himself, could... The contrast between something like academic finish, Jérôme, and so on and so forth, and what Courbet represented, Manet had to go on from Courbet. You know, he saw the greatness of Courbet, but as he said at one point, it's still not ça, c'est pas ça. There was something else that he wanted to do, and there was a lot of space for him to do it, but always in dialogue, in terms of the medium, in dialogue with Courbet. And I think that's part of the, you know, the subtext for the particular kind of painterliness, for the particular kind of work, right? Courbet makes painting as work, as a kind of material project, inescapable.
Mr. Free, I'd like to make this point about Picasso. I think that he's probably the most insightful observant of Manet. In that when you mention the two qualities of facing and striking, which to me equivalent to facing mean perhaps frontality, and striking maybe mean monumentality, how to place form in the static very reductive emotion, which in a way not quite alluding to directly to Davidian space with the Greek trees and so on, reductive of shallow space, but I'm thinking more like through Lennon, through Picasso practice, particularly in the Rose period, like the family circus, you know, the very reminiscent to the musician.
He'd seen the old musician. Absolutely. He'd seen the old musician. Yeah. It's a deliberate allusion.
Yeah, and the other thing I was trying to particularly make the reference to this painting is the massacre in Korea, which he's trying to follow very decisively with Renewed Palace, trying to duplicate in somewhat what he had done in Gernika, but failed in doing so. So I just tried to recontextualize his relation to Manet, what you have said earlier about monumentality and frontality, which is a very particular difference than just you here, the term flatness.
No, thank you. It's interesting.
So shall we, do we have time for one more?
Forgive my ignorance, I'm not a part of the art world, but what strikes me in this picture that you haven't mentioned are the introduction of spectators. And I'm curious if you could comment on why Manet, I mean, I have my own ideas of why Manet put these spectators in, some of whom seem to be blasé, some of whom seem to be shocked about witnessing an execution in the same way that we are today that way.
John and I are both smiling because this is a topic in my pages on the execution, and it's an absolute topic towards the end of John's catalog, and it's one of the places where we don't agree. But we would both agree that the spectators are a kind of important crux in this painting, and something that requires a kind of very specific and heightened address on the part of each of us. In a nutshell, I'm troubled by them. I keep, I don't know if I can even admit this, but I keep looking at this picture and thinking, how much could I shave off the top? Could I come all the way down to the wall? And what would happen if we just had the soldiers and the wall? And anyway, I don't like really so I'm just troubled by it. It feels to me inconsistent in a way that is not consistent with the kind of inconsistency that I regard as consistent in Manet. And so I end up sort of in these pages saying, finally, I regret them. I don't know what. It feels to me like that there's something insoluble about the problem of spectatorship in the picture. I don't see quite what he ought to have done. I can't quite feel flatly that he ought to just cut off the top 2 feet. And then John has a counter reading, which is extremely sophisticated and extremely persuasive, though I'm not sure I'm persuaded, which gives an account of the role of the spectators, which is itself extremely complex and extremely nuanced, and which indeed is predicated precisely on something like their unconvincingness as beholders of this scene. So this is simply to say that you've actually helped us bring the proceedings to a halt, to a close, with a truly great question.
And I think the one thing that we would both agree is that they come from Goya.
For sure.
From Goya's bullfight pictures, from his bullfight etchings, through Manet's own bullfight pictures, and somewhere in Manet's mind must have been the framing of this as a kind of ritualized killing. But that doesn't go anywhere near to address the issue of spectatordom in this, which, you know, is a really complex one. And as Michael says, probably this is a time to thank you for your patience and...